She is a child. She knows nothing. She's like a Disney princess on estrogen.
She could do a lot worse.
It's my daughter.
China is a minor.
A minor what?
Everybody's a pervert. I'm a pervert. We're perverts. Who cares?
The Now Pulled trailer for Louis C.K.'s Now Pulled movie, I Love You, Daddy. HBO is also cutting ties and pulling his comedy specials off their on-demand services. Other companies are making similar moves. Louis C.K. has canceled his public appearances and interviews, and he has released a statement today saying the allegations against him are true. Five women have accused him of masturbating in front of them or of him asking if he can do that. Cara Buckley is a culture reporter for The New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, your reaction to his reaction. He put out a statement today basically saying, yes, this is all true. And he's really apologetic. He says he's remorseful and he didn't realize the extent until I guess he read the story to which he affected these women negatively. What do you make of that?
By saying it's true, it takes some of the sting out of the anger, I would say. He said, at the end, I have spent my long and lucky career talking and saying anything I want. I will now step back and take a long time to listen. A lot of the talk now is about how, you know, these women's, their stories have been suppressed. It's now time to listen to women. I feel like it's a very adept, agile response.
Adept and agile in that, do you think he really does feel remorse or do you think he's thinking about his career or both?
Louis is so good at seeming authentic. I mean, if you see his humor, if you see his TV show, he seems so relatable, so human, you know, self-deprecating, self-hating, that it's almost impossible not to sort of feel compassion towards him. Yeah, I think it's a smart response. It's authentic, I think, as it can be.
And also, he didn't talk to you or your colleagues when you were reporting this story.
His representatives knew 36 hours before publication, roughly, that this was coming, and they had over 24 hours with very specific questions to answer. And the only thing response we got was, Louis is not going to respond to any questions.
Well, as you say, these rumors have been around for a while, for many years, and Gawker reported on them, didn't name the women. Why did the women come forward now? Is it the whole Weinstein era?
It is. Several of the women said, you know, they were inspired by not just by the women coming forward, certainly also by the support they received. Two of the women who are sort of one of the main stories in our story said they felt it was inevitable that their names would get out because just sort of to quickly sketch out what happened in 2002, they're a comedy duo and they had a big break at the Aspen Comedy Festival. They had a showcase there. And Louis invited them back to his hotel room to celebrate. And they thought, well, you know, he's collegial. We look up to him. Sure, the bars are closed. And it was there in that room where he asked, may I take my penis out? And he masturbated. After that incident, they weren't sure, do we go to the police? What should we do? They began telling everyone they saw there what had happened in the hope of triggering some outrage against Louis or shame. Instead, they met people who just didn't want to hear the story, and they sort of backed up away from them. And then they heard that Louis C.K.'s very powerful manager was very angry that they were talking. And they were at the beginning of their comedy career, and they thought, well, we can't talk about this anymore. And so they stopped talking, but the word was out what happened. And it has been kicking around the comedy community for years. And then, you know, with the Gawker story finally coming into more of our mainstream awareness as Louis, his popularity soared. But other, there were rumors of other instances too. But, you know, until this moment, like you've said, they found it very difficult to come forward and decided to now.
I will note that in your story about his movie in September, you ask him about the rumors, and he, it seems like he's brushing them off as just rumors.
He said, I'm not going to address the rumors because that only makes them bigger. And I said, so they're not true. And he said, no. I mean, so he denied that they existed. And that actually was one of the things that prompted the women to come forward.
And then when you look at this movie, you saw this movie.
Yes.
And it's about he has a daughter who's 17 and who engages in a relationship with a 68-year-old.
Yes, his daughter is 17, John Malkovich is 68, and he starts wooing the daughter. And what the film seems to do, it sort of arrives at this conclusion, it's okay, that's okay, you know, she's almost 18. There's a scene that's sort of unrelated, a side character pretends to masturbate very aggressively in front of other people. I wasn't the only one who emerged from the movie with my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it, the audacity of it. I mean, all these rumors are flying around Louis C.K., and then he puts scenes like this in the movie. I asked him about it during our interview, and either he's a really good actor or really clueless, because he said, you know what, I never thought of that. And I just thought, how can you not think of that? But that's what he said.
Why is it called I Love You, Daddy?
He's a divorced dad. He hasn't done a very good job raising his daughter, and she just keeps saying, I love you, Daddy, to get him to send her off in a private jet somewhere or let her vacation and skip school. It's sort of a manipulation.
Right. But it makes you think that there's this, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Just sort of off-putting May-December romance there.
You know, he, like good comedians, they put you into this uncomfortable zone and you just think, is it okay that I'm here? And then he'll bring you out the other side. And he says that's the area he finds very interesting. How provocative can something be? This movie came after Tig Notaro, a comedian who has spoken out against Louis, put in her TV series, One Mississippi, a scene in which a boss masturbates in front of one of his employees. And it was seen as a direct, I don't know if attack on Louis C.K., but certainly clear reference. So that the movie would come out after that episode, and then that the Harvey Weinstein news would break after it, it just seemed like a very poorly timed, ill-conceived film, even though it's visually very beautiful. It has all of these, what people felt were problematic elements.
Right, and now it's been pulled, so...
And now it's been pulled.
No one's really going to see it.
You know what? I bet they're going to see it at some point. It'll be really interesting how people receive this apology. I'm trying to think if we've had that sort of hat-in-hand apology from these other men, you know, who have stand accused of similar things. I don't think we have.
No, I haven't heard that, at least not lately.
So, we'll wonder, will he be forgiven, you know?
We'll see.
Maybe we're not the ones to forgive him. Maybe the women are.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Kara.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Kara Buckley, culture reporter for The New York Times. Coming up, are women being energized politically by these sex abuse scandals? We'll discuss with feminists Roxane Gay and Rebecca Solnit next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A year ago, Hillary Clinton stood in the wings of the Javits Center in New York City under a literal glass ceiling, waiting to break the symbolic one, of course. She never made an entrance that night, but she spoke the next day.
I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now.
A few months later, in January, the day after President Trump's inauguration, millions of women marched in cities across the country. It was the largest single-day demonstration in U.S. history. So now, a year after the election, what is the state of the women's movement in this country? We've gathered a panel of women to discuss. Rebecca Solnit is a columnist at The Guardian and author of Men Explain Things to Me. Welcome to you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Roxane Gay is a writer and author of Hunger and Bad Feminist. Nice to have you back on the show. Hi, Roxane.
Hi, Madeline.
And Chika Dalmia is senior analyst at the libertarian think tank Reason Foundation, and she's a columnist at The Week. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
Rebecca, let's begin with you. You've been an outspoken voice of resistance against President Trump for the last year or so. What does his presidency represent for you?
And it represents a kind of backlash. This is a country in which women have steadily gained rights over the last century. It's a country where half the people under 18 are not white, and the future does not look like the Trump constituency. So it feels kind of like the last gasp.
And Chika, do you agree?
Well, like your other guests, I certainly hope so. But, you know, let me just point out one thing. I'm both a woman and I'm an immigrant, and a brown immigrant at that. And all of those are aspects of my identity, right? But I have to say that I feel less threatened as a woman by this president than more threatened as a minority and an immigrant. And I think it actually is something of a mistake to make this presidency about women rather than all the other threats that he poses to this country.
And is that because he's taken some very real actions against immigrants in terms of...
Right, exactly. When it comes to women, you have to separate his persona from his policies, right? I mean, he has spoken in a demeaning way towards women, but if you examine his policies, he hasn't really done anything, you know, that's going to hurt them all that much. In fact, you know, he has embraced some rather progressive policies towards women. He wants to give paid childcare leave. You know, the recent tax proposal, there are child tax credits for families that will also help women.
Rebecca, what about that? What about this idea of separating his persona from his policies?
I don't think you can separate them. And I think that the policies, starting with reproductive rights and access to health care, have been deeply anti-woman. And of course, the original plan for paid family leave was only going to be for birth mothers, not fathers, not adoptive parents. And so it basically was defining women as primary caregivers, which is like, you know, get out of the workforce, get back into the house. So I think, you know, I'm not going to compete with who has it worse, but I think, you know, the entire atmosphere for women has been extraordinarily hostile, and that does matter.
Roxanne, what do you think? Of course, he also did announce a ban on trans women in the military, so there was at least that action that he tried to undertake.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have plenty of outrage to share across all walks of life. We cannot separate our womanhood from race and ethnicity, from immigration status, from gender, from sexuality. You know, to say that, like, it's so much worse for certain populations just leaves out so many people in the line of fire, in the direct line of fire, because of his policies. And I think for women in this sort of culture that seems to give a pass to the president on sexual assault, where we have to defend our right to access to birth control, we do have to focus on the woman question in addition to everything else.
And what do you think has come from that big women's march, or all of those women's marches that happened on the day after inauguration? I mean, and do you think that there is a women's movement now that perhaps didn't exist a year ago?
You know, the women's march, I think, was an interesting moment, and it was a very nice moment for people to come together. I personally did not march because I was traveling that day, and even if I wasn't going to march. But
why weren't you going to march?
Because I really am frustrated that this is what it took for white women in particular to get on board with activism and with caring, and it didn't take the police-sanctioned brutality against black people that has been going on for decades. You know, I just was like, wow. Mm-hmm. So now that your lives are affected, you care. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm glad that it happened. And that's why I was very supportive of the march. And I remain supportive of the march. But, you know, as a woman of color, as a black woman in particular, that was a bitter pill to swallow. You know, I think that white women are more invested in protecting their whiteness than they are in protecting their womanhood. And I think it also shows just how powerful the patriarchy is. I did an event with Michelle Obama the other day, and one of the things we talked about was that women who voted for Trump were voting against their best interests. And you know, a lot of these conversations that we keep having about what do we do next, and, you know, I think white women need to sit down with each other, because we even saw the same exit polling on Tuesday where white women were voting Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I just feel like y'all need to go fix that, and then we can figure out sort of what to do next. Is frustrating because identity matters, because we are very much affected. As a Black woman in the rural part of the country, when I get in my car, I worry about if I'm going to make it to my destination without, you know, being pulled over and harassed by a police officer. That is a very real thing that is absolutely affected, from the presidency to the state governor to local government to law enforcement. I mean, it's all connected. I can't separate any of it out.
And Shika, what do you make of that? I don't know if you marched at all.
I did not, and I had mixed feelings about it. You know, it's all very well to say, yes, we should be vigilant against this president's threats to minorities and police brutality and, you know, all of that. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, if you prioritize everything, you're not prioritizing anything. And you really do have to decide what, you know, what the major dangers are. And if they don't make these distinctions and they just kind of throw the whole kitchen sink against Trump, I'm afraid that, you know, this angst was not going to stick. It's not going to have much traction in, you know, in politics going forward.
Hmm. Rebecca, I was wondering if you could pick up on that strain of what Shika was talking about in terms of having all these different causes in under one umbrella and how that might dilute the power of what
sure
women are saying.
I'm not sure if it does. I don't want to make Trump the center of the universe and something that we're all reactive to. The feminist movement has a long history. You know, we're in the middle of a feminist insurgency, one of the periods in which people are responding really strongly to violence against women in particular. And Trump erupted in the middle of it, but he's not why there's a women's movement or why we're doing what we're doing now. You know, Weinstein case and all the other cases remind us that we'd be really lucky if there was one man who was our problem.
Roxanne, what do you make of that? It seems that it's been a year about since that Access Hollywood tape came out where, you know, the infamous you grabbing them by the you-know-wheres came out. And now we're dealing with all of this Harvey Weinstein news and the fallout and other Hollywood players as well. So, you know, have we come full circle in a way?
You know, I don't think that we've come full circle. I think that we're just moving in the right direction, finally, after decades, if not centuries, of ignoring women when it comes to talking about sexual assault and sexual violence and how pervasive it is. Women have never been believed. And now we have incontrovertible evidence that it's not all men, but it's a lot of men. But we're talking about sexual assault. But is anything going to happen? Are men going to change? Is the justice system going to accommodate these realities and give women and men who have suffered from sexual violence the justice they need? You know, what about the women and men who are being assaulted by unfamous men, just regular men? You know, when are their stories going to be heard? And what is going to be done about that?
I mean, do you feel that something has shifted? A lot of people are saying it just feels different now, that things that people could get away with a year ago would not be tolerated now.
Well, I think they're continuing to be tolerated. I think something is shifting, but I don't know if it's a permanent shift or a temporary shift. And I'm really hoping it's a permanent shift. But I suspect that a lot of these behaviors are still happening in places where people have power. For example, all of these stories have been coming out, but none of the stories about Donald Trump, which we know about, are being talked about. So it's obvious that within some circles, this is status quo. Mm. And that's disturbing.
Well, I thank you both very much. Rebecca Solnit, author of Men Explain Things to Me, Roxanne Gay, author of Bad Feminist, Hunger and Difficult Women, and Shika Dalmia, senior analyst at the libertarian think tank Reason Foundation. Coming up, filmmaker Sean Baker likes to cast people who have never acted before. He found the star of his latest film, The Florida Project, on Instagram.
I was kind of lonely, so it was just my platform to make myself laugh. And I was posting just jokes and me dancing around and just really silly videos.
Bria Vinyaitya and Sean Baker of The Florida Project are here next on Press Play.
Hi. Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Director Sean Baker's films tell the stories of American places and people that don't generally make it onto the big screen. An illegal Chinese immigrant takeout delivery guy in New York, a young porn actress making friends with an 85-year-old bingo player in the Valley, trans sex workers on the streets of Hollywood. And Sean Baker often casts his movies with first-time actors from those communities. His latest movie is called The Florida Project. It takes place in a real-life, low-rent motel. It's called the Magic Castle Inn and Suites in the shadow of Disney World in Orlando, Florida. And it follows the wild antics of six-year-old Moni and her friends who live there. Willem Dafoe plays the beleaguered motel manager who tries to keep them in line.
It's only second week of the summer and there's already been a dead fish in the pool.
We were doing an experiment. We were trying to get it back alive. That was my idea.
And water balloons thrown at tourists. You can't f*** with tourists.
They didn't tip us.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh my God, this is unacceptable. I failed as a mother, Moni. You've disgraced me.
Harley.
Yeah, Mom, you're disgraced.
All right, I'm joined now by director Sean Baker and Bria Vignette. I hope I pronounced that right. Who plays Moni's mom. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, Sean, how did you end up making a movie there in that hotel? Motel, I should say.
Well, it's a long story, but my co-screenwriter brought this world to my attention. Basically, the situation happening in Kissimmee in Orlando, Florida, in which families and individuals are living in budget motels right outside of the place that we consider the most magical place on earth for children. And this actual place that we shot at is called the Magic Castle Inn and Suites. You can look it up. It's on Yelp. It's right there on Route 192, which is the main artery that takes you through Kissimmee and Orlando
to
the
parks. And it's really bright purple.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of the small businesses along Route 192 are targeting the same tourists that go to the park. So they have bright colors. They're kid-like. They're themed, you know, they're ripping off the mythology of the parks, Disney and Universal, et cetera. So,
and you also cast unknowns or people who've never acted before. One of whom, Bria, I believe, is you. You've never acted before.
Yeah,
this movie. Correct. So how did you find each other?
I found Bria on Instagram.
And what were you doing on Instagram?
I was just using it as a platform to communicate with my friends and just to joke around. I was living in Miami at the time, and I was kind of lonely. So it was just my platform to make myself laugh. And I was posting just jokes and me dancing around and just really silly videos.
And you were just cruising through Instagram and you saw her feed?
By accident. I wasn't looking to Instagram to cast. Somebody I was following reposted one of Bria's posts, and she instantaneously just captured my attention. There was something about her youthful energy, her self-deprecating nature. She was making me laugh, and she had the right physicality for the role. And so there were just many reasons that I thought maybe we should take a gamble with this one and see if she could come down to Orlando and read with the kids that we already cast and see if it works. And it did.
So had you wanted to be an actress, or is this just something that's happened?
You know, it just seemed like such an unattainable thing, so I never even considered it, because I'm the type of person, if I want to do something, I want to do it correct, and to break into that world is such a chaotic thing that I never just considered it. And when Sean reached out, it just seemed like such a surreal thing to get this sort of opportunity through a social media platform. I never expected that to happen. And my biggest concern was just doing a good job, because I had never done it before. I didn't know if I could do it. And I felt like Sean took a very big gamble, and I just wanted to make him happy.
And so how much of the film is scripted versus improvised?
Well, we have a full-length screenplay. My co-screenwriter, Chris Bergosh, and I make sure that we have It all fleshed out with dialogue, but I always encourage improvisation on set. So I ask my actors to loosen it up if they are so inclined. And if they feel as if they can add something, I'm open to that. And there are some scenes, though, that are truly improvised and set up that way from the very beginning. So in my script, there's a scene where mother and daughter have to sell perfume to real pedestrians on the street. And I wanted to shoot that, meaning I wanted my actors to approach real pedestrians and for me to shoot it in a candid camera type style and just capture what would happen. And the wonderful thing about all my actors, but Bria and Brooklyn, Brooklyn Prince, who plays Little Mooney, in particular, is that they have the gift to improvise and to roll with the punches. And so they were basically, I had an earpiece in Bria's ear, and I was just telling her, approach that gentleman and try to sell that perfume, and they would do it, and they would be in so much in the moment that they were able to gauge how to interact with each individual. And so there are moments like that in the film that are like full on improv.
And so then you would get releases after?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And yes. And that's how those scenes unfolded.
Exactly. You mentioned the film Takeout earlier, right? And that was a film in which we had to do that almost with every scene because we were shooting in a working Chinese takeout restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and we couldn't shut their business down for a second. So we would just basically shoot it and then chase the person onto the street and onto the sidewalk and say, we just captured you on camera. Would you give us a release? And it's a gamble because you don't know whether they'll sign it. Tangerine, we had one gentleman on the bus that refused to sign it for under $800. And, you know, I was working on a micro budget and I simply couldn't do it. So we lost the shot.
Yeah, but I think probably people in LA know that deal.
LA people. Angelinos are savvy about the industry. Yeah.
But it's interesting because it raises the point that this movie, sometimes it feels like a documentary. It could have been a documentary. As you say, this was a real story of kids and their families living on the margins of Disney World and the kind of irony of that.
Right.
The Magic Kingdom and the not-so-magic kingdom just outside the gates. And I'm wondering if you ever thought, oh, I should just do a straight documentary.
Well, I'm a dramatist. You know, that's what I do. I love documentaries. I wish I had more time. If I had more time, I would do documentary. But my films are based in realism. So I find worlds that I'd like to focus on, and then I find some sort of fictional story to take place in those worlds.
And talk a little bit more about the relationship between Mooney and her mom. Mm. They seem to have this incredible bond, but it's obvious that she doesn't know really how to be a mom in the traditional sense of keeping her daughter safe.
Well, Haley is a young mother. And what I'm trying to do with this film is ask the audience to perhaps, you know, set aside your judgment for a moment. It's more about empathy here. It's more about walking in her shoes for the 100 minutes that we have of screen time, where you have to look at Haley. She probably had Mooney when she was 15 years old. No formal education, no parental support. Her parents aren't around, and Mooney's father isn't around. She's unemployable. She has a criminal record. She's basically in survival mode, and she makes decisions in that mode. You have to take that into consideration. That's first and foremost what I want the audience to take away from it and to consider while watching the film.
And Bria, how did you come to understand your character and her motivations and how to make her, you know, on the one hand, you kind of recoil at some of the things that she does. On the other hand, you do feel for her. You do feel the love that she has for her daughter.
For sure. It was very helpful that I had a really great relationship with Brooklyn. Having that bond made it so much more real to me because I genuinely loved and cared for her so much. We had an amazing acting teacher on set. Her name was Samantha Kwan, and she really just walked me through every single scene and through. We made a backstory. We did so many things just in character development that really made me understand where Haley was coming from. And the fact that we did the classes at the Magic Castle made me really comfortable being in the environment. Sean had me hang out with some of the women that lived there, and they were very, very open with me and shared their day-to-day struggles and the situations they were faced with on a daily basis. And that was just very helpful. I feel like all the things together just really made me understand Haley on a really deep level and just made me really feel for her.
And she does almost, she's almost childlike with her daughter.
For sure.
I mean, they're almost the same in the maturity level.
Well, that's what I actually, when Bria flew down to Orlando to audition with Brooklyn, I said, I know you've read the script, so I know you know about that it's a mother-daughter thing, but I don't want you to go into the audition that way. I want you to, instead of a maternal relationship with her, I want you to think sibling relationship. She's a young mom. She really never had the chance to grow up herself. The way she's going to interact with her child is going to be on an equal level, as if like sisters. And I think that that's one of the things that Bria just really nailed in that first audition. And it's what made us all very convinced that she could do this, right?
What was that audition like for you?
I definitely didn't know what to expect because I had never auditioned for a film before. But Sean had me meet with Brooklyn and Valeria. And if I'm not mistaken, we just played.
Yeah.
We literally just played, danced around, jumped around, talked, and he taped it on his phone. And that was it. Me and her, literally from the moment we met, we just bonded instantly. She was so receptive to having a relationship with me. And I was very, very grateful for that because she just went just for it.
She's really 6 years old.
She was six when she was six when we were filming.
She's an extraordinary actress. I'm guessing this is her first movie.
Well, no, she was actually in a small micro budget before us, and I'm not sure. Robo Dog 2. And then she had done some commercials. So she had already come with some experience. I have to tell you, though, it was incredible to watch her work. She was born to do this. She loves doing it. And I think she has a really bright career ahead of her.
She reminded me of Tatum O'Neill.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Paper Moon.
Yeah. Bad News Bears.
Yes.
You know, she has that kind of spunky outsider, tough girl attitude.
Definitely. She's sassy. But in real life, she's not really like that, actually. She's
really?
She's very much of a, for lack of a better word, a girly girl. You know, she likes Disney princesses. She doesn't swear. Her parents have raised her in a Christian, with a Christian background, and she's a real, I would say, just the sweetest little girl. She's not nearly as abrasive or street smart as little Mooney.
So the movie's out now.
It is, yes.
And it's gotten some great response. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering if you see yourself now as an established filmmaker in the sense that now you're going to be making bigger budget films rather than these sort of smaller films that you've been doing, these kind of guerrilla style films.
Right. I don't know. I'm still battling with that. I'm not sure. I, of course, would love more money. You always want more money. Just even if you are shooting something that's smaller in scale, you want more money because it brings more tools. It allows you to more time. You know, that's basically what you're looking for more time. But, you know, I don't know what's next. And I don't, it might be even something as small as Tangerine. I'm not sure. It really depends on the subject. It really depends on the world that you're focusing on and the story you want to tell.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's Sean Baker and Bria Vinaitia. She plays Haley, the mother in the new movie, The Florida Project. And Sean Baker is the director of The Florida Project. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Even as a steady stream of sexual harassment and assault accusations roil Hollywood and some new movies are being pulled, like Louis C.K.'s latest, there is still plenty to see at your local movie theater. It's Friday, time for movie reviews. Alicia Malone is here, correspondent for Fandango. Welcome back.
Hello, thanks.
And Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back to you.
Howdy.
Okay, first up, Murder on the Orient Express. All-star cast with Johnny Depp, Judi Dench, Michelle Pfeiffer, etc., etc. A passenger on the Orient Express has mysteriously died.
He was murdered.
God, murder here. God rest his soul.
Someone was rummaging around my cabin in the middle of the night. No one would listen to me.
If there was a murder,
what is going on?
Then there was a murderer. The murderer is with us.
And every one of you is a suspect.
Oh, my gosh. Alicia, you saw this one. There's Hercule Poirot.
Yeah, you say it so much better than I do. Yeah, played by Kenneth Branagh, who also directs the film. And he is the detective trying to figure out amongst all these strangers on a train who might be behind the murder. As you said, it was an all-star cast in there. So many names packed on this train. Unfortunately, you don't get to know too much about the background characters because of the nature of people trying to hold things back, and you're never sure how much they're giving and how much they're hiding. You really don't get to know them at all. This is Kenneth Branagh's movie. He is front and center, him and his mustache. Does a great job with it, but it's definitely his shining moment. And
does this feel like Clue on a Train, basically?
Sort of, yeah. And it does have that kind of old-fashioned classic storytelling, which I like. You know, I love a self-contained story. Plus, the costumes and the production design is beautiful. It just starts to lose steam, wink, wink, as it leaves the station.
And Alicia and I have actually been on the actual Orient Express together.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, they bring it to life in the film, but that train is so small, there's no question there was a murder on it.
I know.
And this 100%. Is a very old story, right? From the 30s, Agatha Christie.
Yeah, and it's set in the 1930s. So it does feel a little bit dated. Mm. But if you do enjoy these kind of classic whodunits, then you might enjoy this one. I'd just say it's definitely Kenneth Branagh's movie. So if you're going to see it for Michelle Pfeiffer or Dame Judi Dench, then you might be disappointed.
And we do end up finding out who done it.
Oh, yeah, pretty easily.
Okay. All right. Next up, Daddy's Home, Part 2. I don't think I saw the part one, starring Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. Their dads join for this installment, played by John Lithgow and Mel Gibson.
This is Sarah's husband.
Why is he here?
Oh, because my dad's coming too.
Dad? Daddy?
Here's my big man!
He hasn't seen his dad in a long time.
It's only been 2 weeks, but it feels like forever!
It does, doesn't it?
And this guy's raising your kids half the time.
Okay, Gray, you have this look of horror on your face.
How dare they tarnish the captain and Tennille both in that clip? How dare they? This is one of those movies that makes me feel like, this is why we can't have nice things. This movie's awful. It's so bad. And I'm the first one to laugh at a comedy about the holidays, about families not getting along. God bless Will Ferrell, John Lithgow, and Mark Wahlberg for trying. But the real problem in this movie, in this current world that we are living in, Mel Gibson, man. Mm. I just can't do it. He's playing a dude whose only purpose is to ruin everyone's Christmas because he's not into what's going on. Well, guess what, Mel Gibson? You've ruined everything else, so why not Christmas? Oh, my God, this movie. Oh, it's brutal, you guys.
It's not funny at all.
I didn't laugh one time.
Really?
I felt nauseated, and I just want everyone to see Bad Moms Christmas instead, because that's a good example of how a comedy can turn your expectation on its ear, if even just a little bit, for a good time at the movies. Daddy's Home 2 shouldn't have happened, and it's not a present to any one of us. It's like coal in our stockings.
How was Daddy's Home 1?
Well, I laughed, and I thought that at least the chemistry between Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg, like they had in The Other Guys, you know, carried over. They're good together. They're funny. They are opposites. And, you know, the fact that they've learned how to live together in this movie world doesn't mean anything to me. I couldn't care less. I want to forget this. And I'm so sorry to these people who are involved. That's always like kind of the part that rips my heart out. When I dislike a movie this strongly, I know a lot of people worked really hard on it. And man, I just wanted to go home.
But it seems like every holiday season we get one of these kinds of movies, or many of these kinds of movies. You mentioned Bad Moms. It's similar, right? It's
It's generations, and it's women, though, in that case. But it's the exact same. Yeah. And the difference is the script, and the difference is the end result. I laughed so hard in Bad Moms Christmas, I look like a mental patient. And I didn't laugh in this one. It made me really sad. And it, bah, humbug.
Okay. Mm. We're not going to see that one. One more movie to review. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Kind of an interesting title there. Starring Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Peter Dinklage. Here's a clip.
I don't think those billboards is very fair.
The time it took you to get out here whining like a bitch, Willoughby. Some other poor girl's probably out there being butchered right now.
We've had two official complaints about those billboards.
From who?
The lady with a funny eye.
A lady with a funny f***ing eye?
A and Fat Dennis.
There's a lot of good friends of Willoughby in this town, Miss Hayes. Ow! Ah! You didn't happen to drill a little hole in the Dennis today, did you?
Of course not.
Huh?
I said, of course not.
Okay, Alicia, this sounds like a comedy, but it's based on a really serious plot point that Frances McDormand's daughter has been murdered.
Yes.
Police haven't done anything, and she's really mad.
Yeah, she puts up these three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, where they live, to try to spur the police on to do something. She's angry, she's mad, she has very good reason for it. And this shows the true mastery of director Martin McDonagh, who is the guy who's behind Seven Psychopaths and In Bruges, that he can make you laugh one second, be shocked the next, cry the next. It deals with real issues. It talks about racism and police brutality and the world that we're living in. Frances McDormand, Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson, they're all brilliant.
Oh, when Frances McDormand finishes speaking in this film, it feels like an atom bomb has gone off. I was so emotionally confused the whole film. I loved it. It kept me guessing. I was totally riveted, and I was very taken just by the beginning of the film when how masterful Martin McDonagh's storytelling is, because I didn't know anything about it going in. Yet this first scene with no dialogue and just really well-crafted technical filmmaking combined with great acting told me so much about the film. It just continues on. It maintains this really strange balance the whole time.
Yeah, and just seeing the preview, I was really happy to see Frances McDormand's face. And it looks like a real woman's face.
Yes.
Yeah. Did I say that? A real
older
absolutely. Woman's face?
And I'd say that her character, although she is tough and she stands up for herself for sure, she definitely has softer moments in there. So you'd get to see her whole range of emotions. And she's just so good, isn't she? I hope
so
she gets an Oscar nomination for this one.
And also a shout out to Woody Harrelson, who just keeps being fantastic.
Yeah.
He's had a killer year, even in movies that weren't necessarily phenomenal, like Glass House. He just keeps being amazing.
And tell us more about Martin McDonagh, the director. As you mentioned, he did In Bruges. And tell us more about him, because he started as a playwright.
He's a playwright. Yeah. He just kind of does movies for fun, it seems like. His last one was Seven Psychopaths a little while ago. And this was worth waiting for.
Yeah, definitely. He has a way with words. He's so clever with his dialogue, with his balance of tone. Such a funny guy at the same time, and works really well with actors. I loved In Bruges, and that was something that showed Colin Farrell in a whole new light. And then Seven Psychopaths, we got Sam Rockwell, who's always great as well. And here, I think this is the best of his three films, because it shows how much he has really mastered his craft.
It's interesting to see how realistic the movie feels, and we relate to that, and then we start wondering if we really want to relate to it at all.
Yeah.
And just being able to constantly shift us between those perspectives, it's unbelievable, this movie.
All right. Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. Good that we ended on that one. I did want to, though, get your comments. I know you didn't see the Louis C.K. movie at the Toronto Film Festival, but do you have any comments on that and what's happening there? I know they pulled the movie.
I think they were right to pull the movie, because even if you just watch the trailer, you can see that it's very much dealing with dating a minor. It's supposed to be making fun of Woody Allen, and it doesn't.
Or maybe not making fun of him.
Maybe being very self-reflective. I don't know, but it just seems like in poor taste right now.
Oh, yeah, that to say the least. My goodness.
Gray Drake is senior movie editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango, and author of Backwards and In Heels, The Past, Present, and Future of Women Working in Film. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You got it.
All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Yes. So you talked earlier on the program about feminism in the age of President Trump. So I posted a Vox poll. It's from a couple of years ago, so it's not recent. It doesn't take into account some of the stuff that's been happening over the last year. But it was interesting because it found that 18% of Americans identify themselves as feminists, even though more than 80% of them support the idea of equality for women. So I asked our listeners whether they consider themselves feminists. Melissa Gary said yes, because it means to me what the dictionary definition is, quote, advocating social, political, legal, and economic rights for women equal to those of men. More than 18% share this view, but due to conservatives making the word mean something different to many, these many won't identify as feminists. And Delaine Ureño says, I branded myself a feminist in the 90s thanks to Susan Faludi's book Backlash, which perfectly lays out the way media has branded the word to distract from the actual work and meaning of a feminist. However, in the wake of 45, numerous friends who were previously afraid of the word have come around to singing it out loud and proud. So there are at least a couple of our listeners who do identify themselves as feminists.
All right. Do you?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. All right. Christian Bordahl, a male feminist. All right. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you on Monday.